My testimony starts, let me tell you about a young girl. Her name was Crystal Palmer, Crystal Michelle Palmer. She was born with a heart defect at birth. In fact, when she was born, the doctors noticed right away there was something wrong. This was back in the early 60s, and the doctors did not have all the same tools and capabilities that they have today. And they realized right away that she has some serious heart problems, and she, in just a few hours, as a newborn baby, she was going to die. So the doctor decided to take some extreme measures, and he was about to perform open heart surgery on a newborn baby. The problem was they didn't have the proper tools in the emergency room that they do have today. So I have been told this story numerous times by numerous people. It is still very difficult for me to believe, but I've got enough sources that have told me the doctor performed open heart surgery by taping a razor blade to his finger and performed surgery on this newborn baby. His surgery was actually successful. However, there were some other problems that occurred from it, but they advised the mom and dad of this girl that she would probably never live to see 9 years old. Well, multiple surgeries later, she lived to be 9. They said she'll probably never live to be beyond 12, and she lived to be 12. And they said she'll never get out of her teens. Well, she was in her teens, and she got her very first job, good old McDonald's. Yeah, wonderful. She's working the fast food window at McDonald's as a 16, 17-year-old girl, and this young man pulled up to the window, pulled up to the speaker, ordered. He pulled up to the window to get his burger and had one of those ooh la la moments, right? Look at this girl, right? So that day, he ordered like 6 burgers 6 different times. Just kept going. It was kind of creepy if you think about that. Like, well, how would you respond to that if you were one of these girls? Like, this guy either really likes burgers or something's up. So after the 5th one, when he finally established he was getting one more burger and mustering up the courage to ask this girl out, he pulled up and he asked her out on a date, which then clued her as to why he got so many burgers. Her parents had established a rule. Crystal's parents had established a rule. She was allowed to date. She grew up in a Christian home. She grew up going to church all the time, but her parents placed this rule. You can date, you're allowed to, but you need to be aware of this. Your only place you're allowed to date is in church, and you can only sit in the pew directly in front of us. That was it. So he says, hey, would you like to go on a date sometime? She said, yes. How about you come to church with me? Well, his name was Tom, and Tom was raised in a Catholic church, and his family was very devoted to the church, and they would go all the time. And he said, this is going to be a struggle. I got to go home and talk to my mom and dad and tell them I'm not going to church with them on Sunday because a really pretty girl asked me to go to her church. So he went home and told them, and the next Sunday came, and they sat in church. Now, what Crystal didn't say at the time was, yeah, sure, let's go on a date to church. And Tom didn't realize until they sat down that Mom and Dad were right behind him. So, anytime he wanted to, not happening, right? None of that stuff. So Tom started going to church with Crystal. Tom ended up getting saved. Crystal's already saved, grown up in church. The two fell in love. Decided to get married. However, due to Crystal's heart complications, they could not have children. So they decided to adopt. That was me, sorry. Anyways, they decided to adopt. They went and filled out the paperwork. This is where it begins to pick up some momentum. Sorry if I bored you so far. They began to pick up some momentum. They went, they filled out the paperwork. They dropped it off at the agency. Now, this is interesting because they were attending the Bible Baptist Church. She grew up in the Bible Baptist Church her whole life. He came out of the Catholic Church, joined that church. They're now married, all these things. But they went to the adoption agency, which was known as Catholic Charities. That was the place in Pittsburgh, the most well-known place to adopt. So they went to Catholic Charities. They filled out the paperwork, and there's a spot on there, on the form, that says, your religion. And they put on that part of the form, they put Baptist. They were only there to fill out paperwork and drop it off. So they took it up to the counter, they dropped it off, they turned around, they were walking towards the door to leave, and the receptionist stopped them and said, hey, hold on 1 second. Wait right there. Is this true? Is what you put on this form true? Well, if you know anything about adoption, they do background checks. They do, like, if you lie on any of that, you're done. It's over, the process is. And so they, well, yeah, it's true. Everything we put on there is true. And so they said, you put on here that you're Baptist, is that? And they said, yes, we are. I said, hold on, wait right here. So the receptionist left. She brought back somebody who was in charge at that time, and they began to talk, and they said, we have a child who is here right now, and there's been some restrictions by his birth parents. He's only allowed to be adopted by a Baptist family, which is kind of strange because they went to Catholic Charities to put me up for adoption. So they said, we have a young man here. He's newly born, and you can take him home today if you want. That was kind of strange because they didn't have their home report done. They're supposed to take classes and CPR class, all these different things, and they didn't do it yet. So I got to go home with them that day. They did take those classes. They did do all those things. And the problem is, as you do all those things, you don't know most of the time if you're waiting months, years. You could be waiting a very long time to bring home a child. And so everybody in those classes is saying, oh, I just can't wait to bring home a little baby, and I just can't wait to. And they're sitting over in the corner kind of embarrassed to tell everybody, we already have our baby. And so they didn't say anything. But at the same time, what's going on here now is through the years, as Tom, my dad, through the years as he had left the Roman Catholic Church, he was disowned by his family. They didn't want anything to do with him. You see, he had walked away from them. He had spit in their face, as they would say it, and so they wanted nothing to do with him. However, they heard that Tom and Crystal were adopting a little boy. So the very first place, once they got me, the very first place they took me was to my grandparents, Tom's mom and dad. Devout Catholics, angry, bitter. I obviously don't remember it, but I'm told the story that as my grandmother held me for the very first time, I think it was gas, I don't know. They said I smiled at my grandmother, right? It's a grandma thing. I melted her heart instantly. Without any words being said, that mended a relationship between my dad and his parents. Well, some time went by. My mom continued to have surgeries. When I was 3, she was 27, she went in for what was supposed to be the last and final surgery. And it was. It was an experimental surgery that had never been done before, and they thought they could fix all of the previous surgeries, all of the previous problems, so she went in for the surgery. The surgery was a success. They were stitching her up, and her heart stopped. So they still had her on the operating table. They opened her back up. They got her heart pumping again, and they began to close her up, and her heart stopped again. They said, well, we procedures to only do this 3 times. And so they went for the 3rd time, got her heart started again, and as they were stitching her up, her heart stopped for the 3rd and final time. I was 3 years old. I have very few and very vague memories of my mom. Really, only 2 instances do I think back of my mom, and both times I was in trouble, however much trouble a 3-year-old could be in. I can remember that. I can remember one specific instance of the key phrase, wait till your dad gets home. I remember that. I remember where I was. I remember, but my mom passed away, and that left just me and my dad. Now, some interesting things happened during this time. My dad was now working 3 jobs. He had to pay for the house. He had to provide for me. He had to do all these things. And so I could not live at home. I'm 3 years old. My dad works 3 jobs. So I moved in with my grandmother and my grandfather, his parents. Now, let me put into context just for a moment. I was an only child. I was adopted. And the reason I was adopted was because my mother couldn't have children. And now my mother has passed away. And I'm living with my grandmother and my grandfather. To say, and this is putting it as mildly as I can, to say I was a spoiled, rotten brat, that's putting it very mildly. I never heard no. I was there. I said I want this, and I got this, and I didn't want this, and I didn't have this. I lived with my grandparents. They had sympathy towards me. I was the only grandchild at the time. And so all of these things. And I began, 3, 4, 5, it wasn't like I was the world's worst kid. I'm 3, 4, and 5 years old, but all right, listen, how many have ever met a 3, 4, 5 year old who's an absolute brat? Be honest, right? Yeah. So that was me. That was who I was. Through that time, my dad was faithful to church. I went with him every Sunday. I lived with my grandparents during the week, got to spend weekends with my dad. We went to church, never missed. About the time I was 4 and a half, my dad met a lady through our church, and they began to date. When I was 5, they married. She had 3 children. All of them were older than me. I went from being an only child, living with my grandparents, spoiled to death, having never heard the word no, to now, I'm the youngest of 4. And no was said frequently to me. I would throw temper tantrums, I would whine, I would cry, I would just throw fits, all of those things. Roles reversed, rather than spending weekends with my dad and the weekdays with my grandparents, I now would spend my weekdays at home, and every Friday into Saturday, I would go to my grandparents. And at 5, 6, 7 years old, I would go to my grandparents who are lost, who are unsaved, who are still devout Roman Catholics, and I would go over to their house and I would say, "My stepmom is the wicked witch of the West. Do you know she told me no? I asked for a cookie and she said no." And my grandparents, I'm not kidding, man. I talked to them. I called them on my way here. My grandparents, as I would say, simple little things. Like, I'm not trying to exaggerate. As I would say, "She wouldn't give me a chocolate chip cookie." My grandparents would go, "Oh, the nerve," right? And I'm like, "I know." I'm like, and that went on for years, and I got pretty good at it. It started at 5, and I remember distinctly when I was about 8 years old, I went to the store with my mom, my stepmom. Went to the store, and it was time for school to start. It was in the fall, and they had this planner. Like, I'm 8. What 8-year-old needs a planner? I don't know. But I saw it, and I wanted it. Man, it was like, this is not really even a thing today, but back then, it was a Reebok planner. Had a little Reebok. I was like, that, I want that. So I asked my stepmom. Just me and her at the store. None of my siblings are there. She could show me some favor, ignore them. That's my thought. I said, "Can I have that? Can we get that?" "No, we can't." "Okay." So I went the next step further. I put it in the cart when she wasn't looking. We got to the checkout. She found it. "I told you we can't get this." "I know, but I thought maybe by the time we got here, you'd change your mind." "No." That was on Thursday. Friday, as every Friday, I went to my grandparents. "Mate," they said, "what do you want to do today?" I said, "How about we go to this store?" "Okay." We went to that store. First thing, it was like this display, like they knew I was coming back. It was this display, first thing when you walk in the store, there's the planner. I didn't have to go to the aisle. I was like, "God is good, look at that." So I walked in, I said, hey, Graham, can I get this?" "Sure, is that what you want?" Sure, okay. So she put it in, we got it, everything was great. Went home, Saturday evening, went home, planner. Dumb 8-year-old, like thinking about, should have hit it, went to my room, you know, all that. No, man. I was surprised as a peacock. I walked in. "Look what I got." She's like, "I told you you couldn't get that." "I know, but my grandmother said I could." And then it, you know, you see where that goes. She took it. Didn't give it to me. Next week, I went back. What do you think I did, right? "Hey, Graham, guess what? Guess what? Guess what Bonnie did?" "She took my planner, and I don't even know where it is," right? Now understand, I'm sharing this part of the story for a reason. My grandparents were lost. They knew nothing of Christ, didn't want anything to do with Christ. And my grandfather began to unload to my 8-year-old mind everything he thought about my stepmom. Really only because I was feeding him these things, but he began to unload all of those things. I went back home on Saturday. And I was bold enough to ask for my planner in such a way that I said, "My grandmother said," that wasn't a good start, "you need to give that back to me or else." And in an exchange of words, she said no. And I said, "Well, then my grandfather was right. You're nothing but," and I began to unload all of my grandfather's thoughts to my stepmother. Not a good thing. So now the rule is established. You're no longer going to your grandparents. It's done. You're not spending the weekends there anymore. And I didn't for a while. One day I decided I was going to run away from home. And I had my little, I don't even know what it was at the time. I still am pretty much obsessed with Ninja Turtles. So I say Ninja Turtle backpack. And I began to walk up the road. And I didn't get all but 2 blocks away from the house. And my dad pulled up. "Where are you going?" And I said, I'm going to Pabst. John, you're not getting in the car. Nope, I'm going to Pabst. I got in the car. We talked a lot of things through. And I realized even at 8, 9 years old, a lot of this was my fault. At 10, I was allowed to go back to my grandparents, do different things. And I remember at 10 years old, my church was having a youth rally. All of my siblings were older than me. I had 2 older brothers, an older sister. My sister's the oldest of us all. And there was a youth rally at my church. My parents decided they were going to volunteer. They were going to help. And so I went. And I had to go because all my family was there. And I remember that night the preacher was preaching. He was a martial arts specialist. And he had kind of a setup like this. He had a stack of cinder blocks about this tall, maybe just a little shorter. And as he was preaching, he was dousing all these cinder blocks in lighter fluid. And it captured my attention. I was sitting front row. And I thought, this is pretty neat. I don't know what he's doing. He began to smell up the auditorium. And then he lit a match and he threw the match on the cinder blocks while he's preaching. All he was doing at this point was quoting John 3:16. And as he was quoting John 3:16, he threw this match and there was this giant fire in our auditorium of our church. I remember it because that's something that doesn't happen in most churches, a big ball of fire in the front. And he pulled back and he broke through that entire stack of cinder blocks. Now he really had my attention. And that's all he was doing, was capturing people's attention. Once he had my attention, he gave the full presentation of the gospel. And at 10 years old, I realized I was lost and I was a sinner in need of a Savior. And that night, I got saved. I remember going back to my grandparents and trying to witness to them. And having now heard stories from my dad, they would get mad at my dad when he would try. They would yell at him. They would end conversations, but not me. You see, I was still the only grandchild at the time. And I'd go over and I would try to witness and they would, that's nice, John. That's okay. All right, that's good. And there were even times at 10 years old I would try to employ some interesting tactics. We would pray. I started praying with them at night before I would go to bed Friday nights. Hey, can we pray together? Sure. All right. And I remember one time I said to my grandfather, all right, Pat, pray after me. Dear Jesus, I know I'm a sinner and I need saving. Amen. Didn't work, right? That didn't go. I remember trying all these things. And through the years, my grandparents just wouldn't give in. Well, I went into my teen years. Still got to spend some time with my grandparents. My siblings and me, we got along very well. I was only 5 when my parents got married. And so, to be honest with you, I'd never really much say that they're my step-siblings. They're my siblings. And in my teen years, there's Kevin. He's closest in age to me. He's 3 years older. Then, this is where things begin to get interesting. Then, after Kevin, there's John. I'm John. He was John. That was good. He's 2 years older than Kevin. And then 2 years older than him is Missy. So, the catch was, about early teen years, John, my brother, not me, John quickly rose to 6'5". Easy way of delineating the two. He was big John. I was not, clearly. I was little John. Big John and little John. That was the easy way of going about. And so we got along well. We wrestled all the time. They were both my brothers, exceed 6 foot. John's 6'5", and typically, he loved working out, doing all those things. He was 350 pounds, and it wasn't fat. Like, he was that big, beefy. And Kevin was always about 6'1". He's a pretty big guy, too. And we'd always wrestle. I would always get the snot beat out of me. I'll admit it. I'm not that. And then if I ever got in a fight and was losing, like with somebody else, they would come to my defense, and it was awesome till we got home, and then they'd beat me up for losing in the first place. It's the way it goes with brothers. But I looked up to them. They're my heroes. And as I got to be about 13, they would have been further on in their teen years. They began to make some choices. Grew up in a Christian home. Went to church. My dad's a deacon in our church. My mom's a Sunday school teacher. But all 3 of my siblings began to make choices that they knew they should have never made. And I share some of this in my testimony, especially in a Christian school setting, because sometimes people think, oh, well, you're a youth pastor, you're a pastor at a church, everything must have went well for you. I can't say that that's the truth for me, and to be honest with you, I can't say that's the truth for most pastors that I know. Even we've had our struggles, our heartaches, our trials that we've had to go through. And I remember my two brothers getting heavily, heavily involved in drugs. I remember it started with one first, and he got heavily involved in drugs and flipped his life completely upside down, got kicked out of so many schools and just different things. And to be honest with you, he was my absolute hero. I looked up to him more than anybody else in the world. He had said years prior he was called to preach. He was called to go into the ministry. And I wanted to follow him, and I wanted to pattern my life after him, and I began to see the turn that he was making. Multiple times I would threaten, I'm telling mom and dad, and multiple times when not in his right stage of mind, he would threaten to take my life if I ever told. Scared me beyond I could ever say. So I never told. He then introduced drugs to my other brother. Years went by. The one who started doing drugs first had sobered up, had cleaned his life up. The one he introduced drugs to, 3 years ago, he overdosed and died. And that's something that we live with as a family now. And I look at that and say, well, but you're a pastor. You don't have to deal with those things. You don't have to see those things in your life. I did. I do. I've seen all those things. And I remember having conversation not very long ago with my brother who's still living. And I said, man, you were my hero. I looked up to you more than anybody else, and I don't know if you knew it. And it was humbling when he said, I did know. I did know. But I just didn't care. Can I say, just pause for a moment and share with you, there are people even in this very room, let alone this school, regardless of who you are, there are people who look up to you. And they're watching what it is that you're doing. Now, you can do one of two things, even as you look up to people. You can do one of two things. You can always learn by watching other people. You can learn what to do, and you can learn what not to do. Sadly, in my case, as I was watching my siblings, I learned what not to do. My two best friends in all the world became my pastor's sons, Samuel and Matthew. One of them is a year older than me. One of them is a year younger than me. We spent all of our time together. I spent, throughout my teen years, because of some things happening at home, I spent more time at my pastor's home than I spent at my own home, and that is not at all an exaggeration. My pastor was the principal of our school, and so many times I would spend the night, Sunday night, after church, I'd spend the night at their home, and we would plead, beg, and just cry that he would cancel school on Monday. It worked more often than you would think. When I was 16 years old, we went to camp. The three of us, we were the three amigos, inseparable. All three of us that summer answered the call to preach. It was awesome. I remember it. It was great. There was a preacher boy competition that week. And I said to pastor, my pastor was there. I said, how do you know you're called to preach? His advice to me was, you're called to preach when you can preach and do nothing else. That made no sense. Not going to lie. You're called to preach when you can preach and do nothing else. I said, I don't know if I'm called to preach. I've never preached. He said, there's a preacher boys competition. You should enter. So I entered. There's no winner. You just entered. You went. And so I preached. And afterwards, we spent hours in counsel and talking. And I said, I think this is what God wants me to do with my life. And so at 16 years old, I surrendered to preach. Went home. I was excited. I told my family. I told my friends. I was ready. I remember telling my grandparents, and they looked at me. Huh? Yeah, I'm called to preach. What does that mean? Are you going to be a priest? No. You're going to listen to people's confessions? No. They're still stuck in Catholic world. And I'm saying, no. So I began to try to witness to them again, and they just didn't want to hear it. Went through my teen years. I ended up graduating. I went off to college. While I was at college, lots of things happened. While I was at college, my freshman year, my pastor got sick with cancer, and my pastor died. My best friend's dad, he was like a second father to me. One day, I told you, we grew up right outside of Pittsburgh. The day that PNC Park, where the Pittsburgh Pirates play, the day it opened, it was early fall 2001. I remember like it was yesterday, man. He came into our classroom. His oldest son was Samuel. He said, Samuel, real stern. Samuel, come here now, son. Just like we're in the middle of class. Samuel was like, okay. So he walked out in the hallway. He was out there for just a little while. He walked back in, head hung low, grabbed all of his stuff. Walked back out. I thought, Sam, man, what'd you do? Pastor comes back in. He goes, Matthew, come here now. Matthew walks in with all this stuff. Walks out. comes back in, head hung low, walks out with all of his stuff. And I'm thinking, guys, like they hardly ever got in trouble. When they got in trouble, they got in trouble. I thought, what did you do, guys? Then it came. John, come here now. And I thought, oh, man, what did we do? Like, what? So I went out in the hallway, and he said, the house, the church parsonage where they lived was on the church property. He looked at me. I'm sitting in the hallway. He goes, go back in, get your things, and go to the house. Like, stern. Like, it wasn't. So I went back in, got all my stuff, walked out, went over to the house and walked in the front door. And there on the couch sat Matthew. There sat Samuel. And I walked in. Pastor wasn't there yet. And I walked in and said, guys, what's this about? And I'm not kidding you. You get it. I said, do you think he found out about? And we began to go down the list of everything wrong we had ever done. Do you think he knows about? So he walks in. He says, go downstairs and change clothes. Well, like it wasn't even my house, right? So what am I changing into? But they gave me some clothes. We changed. He said, all right, meet me in the car in 2 minutes. Still nothing. I'm like, so we get in the car. We begin to drive. He's not saying a word. We're scared to say anything. We end up in downtown Pittsburgh. We live 30 miles outside of the city. We end up downtown Pittsburgh, and there's this scary-looking guy standing on the corner, and he pulls right up to him, puts the window down, goes, hey, man. Hey, you want some tickets? 4 tickets, please. 4 tickets? Oh, they're right beside each other, man. I give you 4 tickets. We look at each other going, we're going to the Pirates game. He just took us out of school to take us to the Pirates. And then he turns the radio on and says, isn't it a great day for the park opener at PNC Park? I was like, this is awesome. Like, and then I thought, does my dad know? Does my mom know? I don't care. I'm going. So we went. The 4 seats, by the way, were not beside each other. 2 were on this side of the park and 2 were on this side of the park. It was great. But I look back at that and I think, man, he was like a second dad to me. We did so many fun things together. My freshman year of college, he gets sick and passes away. Had battled with cancer for some time, very graciously, exercised faith through the whole thing. I go home for the summer after that. And I get a phone call. It was my grandmother, my dad's mom. She says, John, can you come over to the house? I said, sure. I went over to the house and she said, John, I need to tell you something. I have cancer. And I said, I didn't know what to say. She said, but the reason I really wanted to tell you is because the doctor said I don't have long to live, and I don't know where I'm going to go when I die. See, I'd been trying for years to witness to my grandparents. And in that moment, she called me, reaching out, went over and began to talk with her. And that night, I got to lead my grandmother to the Lord. After years of trying through. She said time and time again, I watched Pastor Womack go through what he went through, and it was so much strength and so much grace. I want whatever it is that he had. And in the moment of asking why my pastor died, now God had opened the doors of revelation to me, at least, saying he went through that so that your grandmother would get saved. My grandmother ended up having some surgeries, and they removed the cancer, but it did come back. I remember getting a call while I was at college, my grandmother telling me the cancer's back. They're only giving me a few months to live. And that's exactly what happened. She had just a few months to live. She passed away a week before Christmas the following year. For the time I was home from college, I moved in with my grandfather, and I was trying to help him and do some things with him. And I spent about four weeks with him. I loaded up my car. It was time for me to go back to college. And I got on the road, and I began to drive back to college. I got about an hour down the road, and a song came on the radio, one you may even be familiar with. The song is entitled, That's the Value of One. And it began to play, and as it played, I'm not trying to make this something spooky or something creepy. I'm just telling you the truth. As it began to play, all I could see was my grandfather's face. See, I was confident he wasn't saved. And I'm driving along thinking, if he were to get saved right this moment, all of heaven would be rejoicing because of that. My grandmother, who's now in heaven, would be rejoicing. That would be joy in heaven. I turned the car around, and I went back. I got out of the car, and my grandfather had seen me pull in the driveway, somewhat of a worry ward. He ran out and said, John, what'd you forget? Is it in the house? I'll get it. I said, I forgot something pretty important. He said, well, what? I said, ugh. I got to come inside. So I went inside. He sat in one recliner. I sat in the other. And I said, Pap, if you were to die today, do you know where you'd go? And he didn't answer me at first. And I said, Pap, did you hear me? If you were to die, where would you go? And I saw one tear go down his cheek. And he said, John, ever since that night that you were here and you talked to your grandmother, all she talked about was, it's going to be okay. It's going to be, I'm saved. I know that I'm saved. John showed me from the Bible, and I know I'm saved. You don't have to worry about it. He said, John, every time she said that to me, I wanted to call you and ask you. But I didn't know how. I didn't know what to say. And that day, I got to lead my grandfather to the Lord. Now, I think about this. Didn't make sense at the time. I still don't like that it happened. I can say that. I still don't like that. I don't like that my pastor died. But God used his death to open the door for my grandmother to get saved. I don't like that my grandmother died. But God used that door and that opportunity of her death to open the door so my grandfather would get saved. Let me read to you my life verse. It's in 1 Corinthians 9. 1 Corinthians 9. We know these verses. You don't have to turn to these, but I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians 9. These verses, Romans 8, 28. We know that all things work together for good to them that love God. I think about that. All things work together for good. We know Jeremiah 29, 11. I know the thoughts I have towards you. God is saying, I have a plan for you and I know what it is. I think about that for my own life. God had a plan from the very beginning. To take a little newborn baby to an orphanage run by Catholics, to be adopted by a Baptist family, to see God work through so many different circumstances in my life, to see where I am today. But 1 Corinthians 9, 16 says this, for though I preach the gospel, Paul is saying, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me. Woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. Each and every one of us have the task of sharing the gospel. And we all have a story to share. We all have something we can share with somebody. And can I be honest with you today? The reality of what Paul is saying applies to you and I just as much as it applied to Paul himself. Woe is to me if I don't do it. It wasn't always easy to try to share the gospel with my grandparents. I knew there were times where they were getting angry with me and getting upset with me and not being maybe as loving as they would have been in other situations. I came home from college the following summer, moved back in with my grandfather. I was sitting on the swing with him one night out in his backyard, and he began to ask me questions about my stepmother's mother. Odd questions, such as, do you think she's lonely? Nope, she's not. Is she a good cook? Nope, she's not. What does she do for fun? Nothing, she doesn't have fun. Do you think it'd be okay if I called her? Nope, don't do it. I went home to visit my parents. It was all in the same town. And at that time, my mom and dad were working for the same company. And in the summer months, they take a little dinner cruise on Three Rivers. And my dad said, I think I'm going to invite, they were each allowed to invite a guest. And my dad said, I think I'm going to invite Pat just to get him out of the house. I said, oh, that's good. Hearing our conversation, my stepmother chimed in and said, I think I'm going to invite Grandma just to get her out of the house. You see, her husband passed away years and years and years before. And when she said, I think I'm going to invite Grandma to get her out of the house, I said, time out, don't do it. And my dad said, well, why not? I said, it's not going to end well. He said, John, you're overthinking this. I said, no, I'm not. And he said, John, what's the likelihood of those two getting together? They've been married for 11 years now. My mom's mom and my dad's dad. Right? Yeah, figure that one out. I told you I'm not from West Virginia, but it comes down to it like it is. Lots of things have happened since this transpired. My dad asked me after this happened, this is like still fresh. My dad said, hey, I was visiting with them one time. My dad said, hey, do you know what's for dinner? And I said, no, I don't know, but your sister's in the kitchen cooking. And he said, that's wrong. I was like, hey, man, that's your stepsister. I can't help it, right? I got called into the office right after this happened. I owned a big Chevy pickup truck when I was in college, and I was famous. I always liked to park my truck up on the curbs, like that was just my thing. And I always got I did. I got demerits frequent for it. And finally, one time, they just called me into the office. And I went to the office, and they said, John, man, why do you keep parking on the curbs? And my rebuttal was, it wasn't me. They said, John, it's your truck. We know it was you. It was not me. They said, well, then who was it then if it wasn't you? I said, it was my cousin. And they said, you have a cousin that goes to school here? I said, yes. They said, what's his name? I said, John. And they said, well, what's his last name? I said, Oliar. And they said, you're John Oliar. I said, yes, I am my own cousin. And humor got me out of a couple demerits that time. But yeah, it's weird. My siblings are my cousins. I'm my own cousin. My parents are step siblings. It's very strange. Very strange when you figure it all out. My grandmother had been looking for somebody to spend time with. My grandmother had been looking for somebody. This is weird to say. My grandmother was looking for somebody to date. That's weird. But anyways, for some time she had been looking for somebody. And oddly enough, once I had the opportunity to lead my grandfather to the Lord, you see, it was a very strange series of events. She had met lots of, this is a weird conversation. She had met lots of older men. None of them went to church. None of them were saved. None of them knew Christ. When I led my grandfather to the Lord, her Christian mingle radar went off. I don't know what to call it. It's just, she thought, oh, there you go. And so they married. Now, can I tell you, that would have never happened if I didn't lead my grandfather to the Lord. So, like, my family in some ways blames me that this whole thing happened, but it's okay. It's very strange. Years and years of trying to witness, years and years of trying to just obey God. I share this with our teenagers often, and it's not original with me. I heard it somewhere else. We often make such a big deal, and rightfully so, but we make it so big to say, know God's will for your life and do it. Know God's will for your life and do it. Know God's will for your life and do it. And we think too often that one day we're going to have to wake up and say, okay, today's the day I make the decision. What is God's will for my life? Can I say to you, God's will for your life doesn't just happen one day. It's every day of your life doing what you know you're supposed to be doing. Every single day. So let's start. Here's some basics. What should I do with my life? Well, one of the things we know we're supposed to do is we're supposed to have a daily devotional. We're supposed to be reading the Bible. So if I'm reading my Bible every day, it's likely that God's going to show me something through that. I also know that I'm supposed to have a daily prayer life. So if I'm praying every day, it's likely that God's going to reveal something to me in prayer. I know that I'm supposed to be sharing the gospel. So if I'm consistently sharing the gospel, you might lead your spouse, future spouse, to the Lord one day. You never know. Doing it day in and day out, doing what you're supposed to do and what you know to do. There's so many things, as I look back in my life, that God opened the doors. And I can't say, listen, I'm not saying all this to say, look at me, I've arrived. No, not at all. I'm saying this is how God worked in my life. And the same God that is working in my life is the same God that you serve and the same God that is working in your life. You might think, well, my testimony, I don't really have all these stories. I don't really have all this. Think of all the instances that God has done a work in your life. Well, I was probably the biggest instance that stands out in my mind. When I was at Bible college, it was my freshman year. My pastor had just passed away. Didn't seem like things were going right at all. I just wanted to go home, call it quits. It's time for finals. You can't take your finals unless your bill is paid, and my bill was nowhere near being paid. I was waiting tables at Orion Steakhouse. And a gentleman walked in, looked at my name tag, John. He said, hey, John, how you doing? I said, good. He said, you go to that Bible college up the road, don't you? And I said, yes, sir. How do you know? Weird, but he said, it's your hair. I was like, my hair? What does my hair have to do with anything? He goes, it's just clean cut. It's your hair. Your hair's a giveaway. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, thanks, I guess. That was weird. In the South, it's far different than the North. I grew up, I told you, just outside of Pittsburgh. I waited tables outside of Pittsburgh. When you wait tables in the North, it's give me my food, give me my drink, shut up and leave me alone, go away. In the South, it's totally different. They want part of waiting on tables is a 90-minute conversation. Like, it's weird. So in course of conversation, he says, John, what's your last name? And I said, Oliar. A little freak out moment here as he said, how do you spell that? And I said, Oleyar. And I watched him write that on a napkin, a little wigged out, like, why are you writing my last name down? Okay, whatever. So we talked a whole lot more. It wasn't that big of a deal. After what seemed like 2 hours, he got up, he walked out of the restaurant. Never met him in my life. I looked at the table, And I recognized there's a piece of paper folded over. I recognized right away that it was a check. I just grabbed it. I ran outside. He's still in the parking lot. I said, sir, you left a check on the table. And he said, I know. Have a good night. He got in his car and he drove off. And while he's getting in his car, I open it up. Paid to the order of John Oliar, $1,000. And I stood there for a minute, as probably you would. And I didn't know what to think at first. Is this guy, like, if I had to explain this guy, he's bald. He had the rim hair, and it was real bushy, it wasn't well taken care of. Holes all through his t-shirt. He had those cut off, like, handmade shorts. You know, he took scissors and they were frayed, had holes all through them, with the grandpa white socks to the knees and the Velcro shoes. And I'm standing there going, and he drove off in a little Toyota Tercel that had more rust than any. I didn't know where he was going, hopefully just around the corner. And I stood there going, no way. But I walked inside, went to my manager, ever so calmly, of course. Hey, Scott, look at this. I went back in the restaurant. I was like, Scott, dude, check this out, man. What in the world? Scott looked at it, did the same thing I did. He went, psst. Fake. Hand it back. Next morning, I skipped class. I admit it. Skipped class. Went straight to the bank. Went to the bank when I was supposed to be in class. Handed the check to the teller. I went to his bank, not to mine. I went to his bank and said, hey, is this check for real? She pulled up his account and said, I can't tell you what's in his account, but this check will definitely clear. Sweet. I'll take the cash. Went to the school, put it on my school bill. I was $1,500 short of taking my finals. Now I'm $500 short. I went back to work that night. Guess who came in? The bald dude. He said, hey, I want to sit in his section. And I could see it from across the restaurant. He's pointing at me. And that was the signal. I want to sit in his section. So he sat in my section. Man, I treated him like, whew, better than a king, right? I thanked him 100 times over. Thank you so much. I was so generous. Thank you. Would you like some more sweet tea? I only took one sip. I know, but it went down a little. Let me get you sweet tea. Would you like? It was top notch. I pretty much ignored any other table but his. He got up to leave. He walked out, walked over to the table, and there's a little piece of paper folded over. I looked down, kind of smirked a little bit, opened it up, and I never told him. I never said a word to him about my financial situation at college. I opened up a piece of paper, $500. Check. Pay to the order of John Oliar, $500. In 2 days, guy gave me $1,500. Never met him before in my life. All he said was, I could tell by your hair. Let me give you a hint. Keep your hair nice and maybe you'll get $1,500, okay? So he said, I could tell by your hair. Gave me $500. So I went, put it on school bill. Through the course. Now listen, today I call this man Grandpa. Yeah, through the course of college, I ended up going 5 years. I got my master's and my undergrad. In the course of 5 years, he paid for 4 of them. Total stranger I had never met in my life. Again, I don't share that story to say, hey, look what I've done. No. This is a complete stranger I had never met. I say, look what God can do if you allow him to have proper place in your life. Woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. You see, when my pastor died, I told you, I was contemplating, I just want to go home, call it quits. But I knew God had a calling on my life to preach. When my grandmother died, I thought, I want to stay home. I don't want to go back. I just want to come home and be with my family. And I thought, no, God has called me to do this. And I persevered. And the whole way, God provided. Listen, I don't know where you're at in your life. This is just my story. And I know, I'm sorry, it's a little different. I didn't full-blown preach, but I want you to know and I want you to understand where you are in your life right now. God can, God will, and God wants to do big things in your life. He wants to. Sometimes you may come to school, I get it, I was there. I went to a public school for some time. I went to a Christian school for some time. Sometimes you just may want to be done and say, man, you might come to school with an attitude. You might come to school and just say, I've had it. You might even sometimes think to yourself quietly, because you wouldn't ever admit it, I just don't know if the Christian life is worth living. I see the decisions some of my friends are doing. I see some of the things, they seem like they're having fun. Can I tell you from firsthand experience of seeing others who went down that road? Sin is only pleasurable for a season. It will catch up. Listen, we all have our bad days. You're going to have days where you don't want to go to school. I'm at the point now where I have to get my kids ready for school every morning, and I don't even want to do that, right? It's just the truth. I understand that. But stay faithful to God, trust in Him, and I promise you, He has blessing upon blessing upon blessing that He wants to pour down on you, and He wants to give you for your faithfulness in serving Him. Heads bowed and eyes closed. I want to ask this question real quick, and then I'll turn it over. How many of you in this room today, how many of you have a lost loved one, a lost family member? Would you raise your hand? I have a lost family member. Thank you so much. Can I tell you, that was a lot of hands. You can put your hands down. That's a lot of hands. How many of you, answer this yourself, please don't raise your hand. How many of you faithfully,